anywhere in the world could more fittingly be characterized as eternal. Preferred and non-preferred groups. Just as we cannot presuppose continuing control over the scope and duration of preferential policies, so we cannot simply assume what will actually happen to those designated as the preferred group or groups. Neither they nor the non-preferred groups are inert blocks of wood to be moved here and there according to someone else's grand design. Both confront laws and policies as incentives and constraints, not as predestination, and react in their own ways. These reactions include redesignating themselves, altering their own efforts and attitudes toward achievement, and altering their attitudes toward members of other groups. Designation and redesignation. One of the reactions of members of non-preferred groups has been to get themselves redesignated as members of the preferred group. This can be done either individually or collectively. Some individuals of mixed ancestry who have been regarded and self-identified as members of Group A may choose to redesignate themselves as members of Group B when Group B is entitled to preferential treatment and members of Group A are not. In the United States, during the Jim Crow era, some light-skinned blacks simply passed as white in order to escape the legal and social disadvantages that went with being designated black. Later, during the era of affirmative action, whites with traces of American Indian or other minority ancestry likewise redesignated themselves in order to take advantage of preferential policies for disadvantaged groups. These have included blonde-haired and blue-eyed individuals with official papers showing some distant ancestor of another race. The number of individuals identifying themselves as American Indians in the U.S. Census during the affirmative action era rose at a rate exceeding anyone's estimates of the biological growth of this population. Moreover, a breakdown of census data by age cohort shows that the number of American Indians increased over time in the same age cohort, a biological impossibility made possible on paper by redesignations of the same individuals. For example, the number of American Indians who were aged 15 to 19 in 1960 was just under 50,000. But 20 years later, when these same individuals would be in the age bracket 35 to 39 years old, there were more than 80,000 American Indians in that cohort. In other words, more than 30,000 people in the same cohort who had not designated themselves as American Indians in 1960 now did so in 1980, causing more than a 60% increase in the number of American Indians in that cohort. A similar pattern emerged among the Aborigines in Australia. A study in that country found that there was a 42% increase in the size of the Aboriginal population between the 1981 and the 1986 censuses, virtually a demographic impossibility in 5 years, except by redesignation of the same individuals with different ethnic labels. As an Australian scholar has noted, the dramatic increase in numbers has much to do with record-keeping, increasing intermarriage, and the growing availability of substantial subsidies to people of Aboriginal descent. The definition of Aboriginal includes many persons of predominantly non-Aboriginal descent who might, with equal or greater genetic justification, designate themselves as non-Aborigines. It was much the same story in China, where, in the 1990s, more than 10 million Chinese proclaimed their ethnic minority status in order to gain preferential treatment, such as college admissions. Even China's draconian restrictions on having more than one child did not apply to ethnic minorities as they did to the majority Han Chinese. Article 44 states that, in accordance with legal stipulations, autonomous areas can work out their own family planning measures. As a result, urban minority couples generally may have 2 children, while urban Han are restricted to 1. Rural minorities may have 2, 3, 4, or even more children, depending on their ethnicity and location. An official of China's State Nationality Affairs Committee commented, some people would try all means to change their nationality because they wanted to make themselves eligible to enter a university with lower scores or to stand a better chance than their colleagues when it comes to promotion. As in other countries, people with mixed ancestry had the option of choosing how to designate themselves. Some traced their ancestry back hundreds of years to prove minority blood and claim the benefits. Another individual response to preferential policies has been to use someone genuinely of the qualifying ancestry as a front for businesses seeking preferential treatment in the awarding of government contracts or other desired benefits. This practice has been so widespread in both Indonesia and Malaysia that it has acquired a name, Alibaba Enterprises, where Ali is the indigenous individual who ostensibly owns the business and is legally entitled to government benefits, while Baba is the non-indigenous person, usually Chinese in these countries, who actually controls the enterprise and essentially pays Ali for the use of his name and ancestry. Similar arrangements have been uncovered in the United States and elsewhere. Anti-Semitic policies in Poland during the years between the two world wars likewise led some Jewish businesses there to operate behind Gentile frontmen. Decades later, under preferential policies in Kenya, Africans served as fronts for Asian-owned businesses, as they likewise served as fronts for Lebanese-owned businesses in Sierra Leone. Members of some non-preferred groups can also get themselves redesignated collectively. The 14th Amendment to India's Constitution, like the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, provides for equal treatment of individuals, but India's Constitution provides explicit exceptions for benefits to the untouchables, disadvantaged tribal groups outside the Hindu caste system, and other backward classes. This last proviso especially has created opportunities for many other groups to get themselves collectively designated as being among the other backward classes. Eventually, this miscellaneous classification provided more individuals with the coveted rights to preferential treatment than were provided to the members of the untouchable and tribal groups for whom the preferences were created. In 1997, organized efforts were also begun to seek preferential treatment for India's 15 million eunuchs, though obviously they were not the descendants of other eunuchs, and so could not inherit historic group disadvantages. Redesignations of individuals and groups, like the spread of preferences from given groups to other groups, take preferential policies further and further away from the initial rationales on which they were based. No historic sufferings of blacks in the United States can justify preferential benefits to white women or to recently arrived immigrants from Asia or Latin America who happen to be non-white, but whose ancestors obviously never suffered any discrimination in the United States. Similarly, the painful history and continuing oppression of untouchables in India can hardly justify preferential benefits to local majorities in particular states, such as Assam, Maharashtra, and Andhra Pradesh. Yet these local majorities and members of other backward classes outnumber the untouchables and are often in a better position to take advantage of the preferences. Thus, quotas for government jobs or university admissions have often remained unfilled by untouchables, while this has seldom been the case for members of the other backward classes. The spread of benefits from group to group not only dilutes those benefits, especially when more than half the population of the country becomes entitled to them, as in both India and the United States, it can also make the initial beneficiaries worse off after the terms of the competition are altered. For example, in the United States, where hiring and promotions decisions are subject to review by government agencies investigating discrimination, objective criteria may be used increasingly by employers for legal self-protection, even if the relevance of these criteria to the job are questionable. If these criteria are met more often by one of the preferred groups than by another, if white women have college degrees more often than black men, for example, then one preferred group may be no better off, on net balance, than if the preferences did not exist. It is conceivable that they can be worse off. Such a situation is not peculiar to the United States. An official report in India in 1980 noted that the advancement of one preferred group tended to push back another, creating greater tension between structural neighbors in this hierarchy than between the top level and the bottom level. That continued to be so in the 1990s, with violent clashes in several Indian states being found to be more common among competing poorer groups than between those groups and the more elite castes. In 2001, a rally was held in the state of Rajasthan, protesting the inclusion of new groups among the backward classes and demanding separate fixed quotas for original backwards, so that new entrants would not be able to reduce the existing benefits enjoyed by those for whom the preferences were created. Calls have been made for a quota within quota to deal with such situations. Insofar as affirmative action policies are aimed particularly at offsetting existing economic disadvantages, their rationale is undermined when the benefits of these policies go disproportionately to those individuals within the designated groups who are the least disadvantaged, or perhaps are in more favorable positions than members of the country's general population. In India's state of Tamil Nadu, for example, the highest of the so-called backward classes legally entitled to preferences, constituting 11% of the total backward classes population in that state, received almost half of all jobs and university admissions set aside for these classes. In Malaysia, where there are preferences for the indigenous sons of the soil majority, Malay students whose families were in the top 17% of the income distribution received just over half of all scholarships awarded to Malays. In Sri Lanka, preferential university admissions for people from backward regions of the country appear likewise to have benefited primarily students from affluent families in those regions. This should hardly be surprising, nor is it necessarily a matter of corruption. Preferential access to education or jobs is just one factor in getting the education or the job. Obviously, those people who have more of the other factors required are better able to turn preferential access into actual success. Pre-existing prosperity provides more of those other factors. Those American minority business owners who participate in the preferential program called Business Set-Asides under Section 8A of the Small Business Act average a personal net worth that is not only higher than the average net worth of the groups they come from, but also higher than the average personal net worth of Americans in general. A scholarly study of group preferences in India pointed out that preferences that benefit more fortunate members of less fortunate groups borrow legitimacy from the national commitment to ameliorate the condition of the lowest, while at the same time they undermine that commitment by broadcasting a picture of unrestrained preference for those who are not distinctly worse off than non-beneficiaries. Just as specifying the scope and duration of affirmative action policies has proven illusory, so has the designation of the beneficiaries in accordance with the rationales of these policies. Both attempts suffer from assuming far more comprehensive knowledge and control than anyone has been able to exercise in any of the countries in which preferential programs have been instituted. What has also been overestimated is the extent to which the attitudes resulting from such programs can be assumed to be beneficial to the groups concerned or to the country at large. These attitudes tend to respond to incentives rather than to rationales. Incentives. Both preferred and non-preferred groups have modified their own behavior and attitudes in response to preferential policies and the rationales for such policies. While members of the officially preferred groups who already have the complementary factors needed to take the fullest advantage of preferences can do so, those who lack these factors often feel less incentive to acquire them, now that entitlements are available as substitutes for achievements. The development of job skills, for example, may be de-emphasized. As a leader in a campaign for preferential policies in India's state of Andhra Pradesh put it, "Are we not entitled to jobs just because we are not as qualified?" A Nigerian likewise wrote of the tyranny of skills. In Malaysia, where group preferences exist for the majority population, Malay students, who sense that their future is assured, feel less pressure to perform. In the United States, a study of black colleges found that even those of their students who were planning to continue on to postgraduate study showed little concern about needing to be prepared because they believed that certain rules would simply be set aside for them. Both preferred and non-preferred groups can slacken their efforts, the former because working to their fullest capacity is unnecessary, and the latter because working to their fullest capacity can prove to be futile. After Jamaica gained its independence from British rule, many whites living there no longer bothered to compete for public office because they felt that the day of the black man had come and questioned why they had to make the effort if the coveted job or the national honor would go to the blacks, despite their qualifications. While affirmative action policies are often thought of, by advocates and critics alike, as a transfer of benefits from one group to another, there can also be net losses of benefits when both groups do less than their best. What might otherwise be a zero-sum game can thus become a negative-sum game. In some countries, complete physical withdrawal from the country by those in non-preferred groups has occurred in the wake of preferential policies which reduced their prospects. The exodus of Chinese from Malaysia, Indians from Fiji, Russians from Central Asia, Jews from much of pre-war Europe, and Huguenots from 17th-century France, in response to discrimination, drained all these countries of much-needed skills and talents. In short, preferential policies represent not simply a transfer of benefits from one group to another, but can also represent a net loss, as both groups respond by contributing less than they could to the society as a whole. Not all incentives are economic or even tangible. Honors are among the most powerful of incentives in many situations, especially where dangers and death must be faced, and where money is less effective than a sense of honor, as in the military. In less dire circumstances as well, honor and the respect of peers play important roles, not only as rewards for achievements, but also as factors helping to make individual achievements possible in the first place. The cooperation and collaboration of colleagues can be important in a variety of occupations, from scholars to policemen, and that cooperation and collaboration can be compromised by group preferences. For example, minority professors on American campuses have complained that being thought of as affirmative action professors by their colleagues has led to less intellectual and research interaction, which in turn reduces the minority faculty's development as scholars. This can be a serious handicap in achieving one's potential. In life and death situations, such as those faced by the police, firefighters, and soldiers, mutual confidence is even more important. Yet black police sergeants promoted in Chicago over white policemen with higher test scores, as a result of a court order, found themselves taunted as quota sergeants when they made mistakes. Intergroup relations. Even aside from losses to the economy as a whole, because of disincentives created for both preferred and non-preferred groups, there are social losses due to intergroup resentments, which can be even more serious. Nor are these resentments due simply to the transfers of benefits. When a serious political backlash against affirmative action began in the United States, many in the media were quick to characterize it dismissively as due to angry white males, resentful of the losses of various benefits to blacks and other minorities. In other words, just an emotional reaction by people irked at losing a few of their many advantages. But this resentment was by no means proportional to intergroup transfers of benefits, or it would have been far greater against Asian Americans, who displaced more whites in prestigious universities and in many high-level professions, especially in science and technology. At many of the leading universities in the United States, whites lost more places to Asian Americans than to blacks, and yet there was seldom any backlash against Asian Americans. The outstanding academic and other achievements of Asian Americans were widely recognized and widely respected. It was not the intergroup transfer of benefits that was resented, but the basis for those transfers. Among Americans especially, the idea that some are to be treated as more equal than others is galling. It was this feeling in the general population which leaders of the civil rights movement of the 1960s were able to mobilize behind their efforts to destroy the Jim Crow laws of the South, so that a majority of the members in both houses of Congress from both political parties voted for the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It was this same American resentment of special privilege which responded so strongly to the historic words of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, that his dream was of a country where people would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. It was after the civil rights movement itself began to move away from this concept of equal treatment of all individuals and toward the concept of equalized outcomes for groups that a backlash against affirmative action set in and grew over the years. There is yet another sense in which resentments against preferences for other groups are not proportional to the benefits transferred. An observer of preferential policies in India noted the disproportionate resentment of places reserved for scheduled castes, the official euphemism for untouchables. We hear innumerable tales of persons being deprived of appointments in favor of people who ranked lower than they did in the relevant examinations. No doubt this does happen, but if all these people were, in fact, paying the price for appointments to scheduled castes, there would be many more SC persons appointed than there actually are. To illustrate, supposing that 300 people qualify for 10 posts available. The top 9 are appointed on merit, but the 10th is reserved, so that the authorities go down the list to find an SC applicant. They find one at 140, and he is appointed, whereupon all 131 between him and the merit list feel aggrieved. He has not taken 131 posts, he has taken one, yet 131 people believe they have paid the price for it. Moreover, the remaining 159 often also resent the situation, believing that their chances were, somehow, lessened by the existence of SC reservations. In the United States as well, those who resent group preferences may be some multiple of those who have in fact actually lost anything that they would have had in the absence of these preferences. In the 1978 landmark Supreme Court challenge to affirmative action brought by Alan Bakke, a white student denied admission to a University of California medical school, neither side to the dispute could state with confidence that Bakke would or would not have been admitted in the absence of the affirmative action policies which admitted minority students with lower academic qualifications than his. The admissions process was sufficiently complicated that it was not clear whether some other white or Asian American students might have been admitted instead of Bakke. In other words, it was not certain that Bakke had in fact lost anything as a result of affirmative action, and yet his sense of being wronged was sufficient for him to pursue the case all the way up to the highest court in the land. One of the things that prevents affirmative action from being a zero-sum process is that minor transfers of benefits can cause major resentments among far more people than those who have actually lost anything. Moreover, these resentments do not end with political or legal actions. In India, where preferential policies have a longer history than in the United States, they have also had more bitter consequences. 42 people died in riots over places reserved for untouchables in a medical school in the state of Gujarat, just 7 places. This was part of a national trend of rising violence against untouchables amid adverse reactions against preferential policies in general. Meanwhile, less than 5% of the medical school places reserved for untouchables in Gujarat had actually been filled over a period of years. Studies of university admissions in general, in various parts of India, showed a similar pattern of many places reserved for untouchables going unfilled. Nevertheless, minor transfers of benefits led to major resentments, including resentments erupting repeatedly into lethal violence. Nowhere has this resentment led to more violence than in India's neighboring nation of Sri Lanka, which has been racked by decades of civil war in which the non-preferred group, the Tamils, have sought to secede and become an independent nation. It is clear that affirmative action in Sri Lanka has not been a zero-sum process. The material, political, economic, and social havoc created by that country's long civil war has undoubtedly left all segments of the population worse off than they would have been in the absence of group preferences and the reactions to which those preferences led. Trends. Even where there are adequate statistical data on the progress of groups that have been given preferential treatment, and often there are not, it remains a challenge to determine how much of that progress was due to preferential policies rather than to other factors at work at the same time. Simple before and after comparisons will not do, as that would be assuming that nothing else had changed, when in fact the very dynamics of establishing affirmative action programs often reflect changes that were already underway before group preferences began. Seldom is there a stationary situation to which a given change is added. Often it was precisely the rise of newly educated and upwardly mobile groups which led to demands for preferential policies. A study in Bombay, for example, found a marked advancement of the Maharashtrians occurred prior to the stringent policy measures adopted by the state government to promote preferential hiring of indigenous Maharashtrians. In part, this reflected a prior enormous growth in school enrollments in Maharashtra and a rapid expansion in college enrollment, also prior to preferences. In Malaysia as well, the number of children attending the government's secondary schools increased by 73% in just 5 years, immediately preceding the new economic policy, which expanded preferences and quotas for Malays. In Sri Lanka, likewise, there was a rapid expansion of educational opportunities in the Sinhalese areas after independence, and before demands for preferential treatment of the Sinhalese. A similar growth of an indigenous, newly educated class in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Lithuania during the years between the two world wars led to demands for preferential policies in the form of group quotas in order to relieve them from having to compete on an equal plane with Jews, who were already educated, experienced, and established in the positions to which the newly educated classes were aspiring. Likewise, in Nigeria, it was the recent growth of an educated class in the north that led to demands for preferential policies to relieve them from having to compete with southern Nigerians who had predominated in universities and in many desirable occupations. This same pattern of a rising educated class prior to the preferential policies that they promoted can also be found in Indonesia, the Quebec province of Canada, and much of sub-Saharan Africa. In the United States, the proportion of the black population going to college doubled in the two decades preceding the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s, and this was reflected in the occupational rise of blacks. While it is an often cited fact that the proportion of blacks in professional and other high-level occupations rose substantially in the years following passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it is an almost totally ignored fact that the proportion of blacks in such occupations rose even more substantially in the years preceding passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Dramatic progress was also evident during these same decades in the lower socioeconomic levels of the American black population. The percentage of black families with incomes below the official poverty line fell from 87% in 1940 to 47% by 1960, all of this before the civil rights legislation of that decade, much less the affirmative action policies of the 1970s. Between 1960 and 1970, the poverty rate among black families dropped an additional 17 percentage points, and, after the decade of the 1970s in which affirmative action was established, the poverty rate among blacks fell one additional percentage point. This striking difference between the political myth and the economic reality has many implications. Among them is that what might otherwise be seen as a remarkable achievement by black Americans is instead seen as an example of government beneficence and largesse, and a reason why affirmative action is an absolute necessity for Black advancement. The effects of this misperception include white resentments and their questioning why Blacks cannot advance themselves like other groups, when in fact that is what most Blacks have done. Incidentally, it is an equally ignored fact that the incomes of Asian Americans and Mexican Americans rose substantially, both absolutely and relative to that of the general population, in the years preceding passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its evolution into preferential policies. Any assessment of preferential policies must take account of pre-existing trends, rather than assume a static world to which change was added. Summary and implications. Despite the highly varied rationales for official group preferences and quotas in particular countries around the world, the logic of their incentives and constraints tends to produce similar consequences in very disparate societies. Moreover, both the incentives and the consequences tend to get ignored in political discussions of these policies, which focus on their justifications and presumed benefits while ignoring actual empirical results. In the United States, mythical results, affirmative action as the basis for the economic rise of Blacks, for example, have so completely supplanted facts that few who discuss this policy find it necessary to check historical evidence at all. For some supporters of affirmative action, it is just a matter of being in favor of helping the less fortunate, with the details being left for others to consider and work out. However, even a broad brush look at what affirmative action programs have actually done in various countries reveals that a failure to achieve their goals may be the least of the problems created by these programs. Poisonous intergroup relations and real dangers to the fabric of society have also been produced by affirmative action in some societies. The influence of geography. Few unsubstantiated ideas have done as much social damage, sometimes tearing whole societies apart, as the assumption that there is something strange, if not sinister, when racial, ethnic, or other groups are not evenly or randomly distributed in particular endeavors, institutions, occupations, or income levels. However plausible that assumption might seem when thinking in terms of abstract people in an abstract world, when it comes to real people in the real world, that assumption is not merely unsubstantiated, but in defiance of mountains of evidence to the contrary in countries around the world and going back for centuries. Geography alone is enough to make peoples different, though geography is just one of many influences that differ from one place to another, and therefore from one people to another. Geography, economics, and culture. The geography of the Mediterranean world is quite different from the geography of Southeast Asia, not only in terms of such obvious things as soil and minerals, but also in terms of rivers, mountains, climates, disease environments, and other factors whose influences expand or limit the possibilities of different peoples in different ways. The sense of a dependable abundance, fish in the water, rice on the land, as a Thai saying has it, could hardly have been common in the Mediterranean world, where the barren hills, scanty rainfall, and thin soils made survival a struggle and made the peoples of the region renowned for their frugality. Moreover, geography cannot be thought of in two dimensions, as if we were looking down at a map or globe. While a whole region may be dominated by a particular culture, as the Middle East and North Africa have been by the Islamic culture, peoples living in mountainous parts of the same region, in Armenia or Abyssinia, for example, may preserve a very different religion and culture from that in the lower elevations. Mountains. Even when Islam became the religion of the Rif Mountains in Morocco, this happened centuries after Moroccans in the lowlands had become Muslims. Similarly, the English language prevailed in the Scottish lowlands, while Gaelic continued to survive in the highlands for generations, just as the Vlach language survived in the Pindus Mountains of Greece long after Greek prevailed in the lower elevations. Mountains and uplands have in fact isolated peoples culturally and economically, from the Scottish Highlands to the highlands of colonial Ceylon, which in both cases maintained their independence for many years after their respective lowlands were conquered and incorporated into another cultural universe. Even mountainous regions nominally under the control of a larger nation or empire have not always and in all places been effectively under such control. The mountains of Montenegro under the Ottoman Empire, the Rif Mountains under Moroccan sultans, and the uplands of India under the Mughal rulers, for example. Isolation has been a key factor in both political autonomy and cultural separatism, as it has been in the enduring poverty of many mountain regions. In the Apennines Mountains of southern Italy, 91 out of 123 Lucanian villages had no roads whatsoever in 1860. In parts of the Pindus Mountains of Greece, even in the 20th century, there were places more accessible to mules and to people on foot than to wheeled vehicles, and one village acquired electricity as late as 1956. In the Rif Mountains of Morocco, snow continued to cut off some communities completely in wintertime, even in the late 20th century. The cultural isolation of mountainous communities has been partially relieved by the temporary migrations of its men to lower elevations in search of work, returning with at least a glimpse of another way of life, though the women who remained behind lacked even this. Moreover, few people from other places have come to live in these mountain villages to present a different viewpoint. Often the great majority of marriages have involved women and men not only from the same mountains, but from the same village. Finally, the poverty of many mountain peoples has often led them to utilize their children's labor from an early age, even at the expense of their education, thereby cutting off yet another source of a broader exposure to the outside world. Another pattern found among mountain people in various parts of the world, at least in recent centuries, has been the production of a wide variety of home-based arts and crafts during the long winter months when time is available. Swiss wood carvings, for example, have had their counterparts halfway around the world in Kashmir, as well as closer to home in Norway. Numerous other products of home-based crafts, from weaving to metalwork, have issued from mountain communities and have been sold in the international markets as items of large value in a small physical size, able to bear the high transportation costs from mountain regions. The toughness required to survive in many barren and backward mountain regions has produced renowned fighting men in many parts of the world, from the Highland Scots to the Gurkhas of India, the Albanians, the Moroccan Rifians, the Montagnards of Vietnam, and the Turks, all formidable not only in their own homelands, but also in the service of foreign countries. The elite Scottish Highland regiments and Gurkha units of the British military forces had as counterparts the Albanians and Rifians, who fought in the Ottoman armies, as well as the 50,000 to 60,000 Rifians who fought on the side of Franco during the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. It has been estimated that somewhere in the vicinity of 1 million Swiss soldiers were killed in other people's wars between the 15th and the 18th centuries. The fighting qualities of mountain men have also taken the form of local brigandage and blood feuds in their homelands. Marauders from the highlands have preyed on more prosperous communities in the lowlands for centuries, whether Kurds raiding Armenian villages, Scottish Highlanders raiding Scottish lowlanders, or similar activity in Italy, Spain, the Balkans, India, and Tibet. Feuds have also been outlets for the fighting ability of mountain men. The celebrated Hatfield and McCoy feud of the American Appalachian region was not only an example of a custom that went back to the parts of Britain from which so many Southerners came, it had its counterparts in similar tribal or clan feuds in the Rif Mountains of Morocco, in the Balkan Mountains of Montenegro, in the mountains of the Caucasus, and in the mountains of Taiwan. The minerals found in some mountains present opportunities for mining and for the development of skills connected with mining. Thus, the Germans in the Harz Mountains became renowned as miners, leading to a demand for Germans to work in the mines of other countries, whether in Bohemia, Norway, Spain, the Balkans, or Mexico. However, the very fact that Germans were imported into all these countries suggests that geography presents opportunities which people are not predestined to grasp. For otherwise, all the mountains and other sources of mineral deposits in all these other countries would have led to the development of indigenous miners, obviating the necessity to import Germans. In geographical terms, mountains and highlands in general are important not only as obstacles in themselves, but also as features with both positive and negative effects on other parts of the environment. Rivers and streams flow more steadily because of the snows melting on the mountainsides, whereas their volume of water varies much more widely and more erratically when there are no mountain ranges, as in tropical Africa, where rainfall alone must sustain these waterways, or fail to sustain them. The Sierra Nevada in Spain and the Taurus Mountains in Turkey both supply the water that makes a flourishing irrigated agriculture possible on the plains below, where rainfall alone would not be sufficient. In another sense, however, uplands have a negative effect on rivers, which must plunge more sharply downward, often with rapids and waterfalls, when the streams originate at higher elevations, whether on plateaus, mountains, or foothills. Rivers with steep gradients tend to be less navigable, or not navigable at all. Mountain ranges also drastically affect rainfall patterns. When moisture-laden air blows across a mountain range, it is not uncommon for the rainfall on the side where the moisture originates to be several times as great as in the rain shadow on the other side of the mountain, where the air goes after it has lost most of its moisture while rising over the crest. The net result is that people located on different sides of a range of mountains or foothills may have very different agricultural opportunities. On some western slopes of southern Italy's Apennines Mountains, for example, the annual rainfall reaches 2,000 millimeters, while parts of the eastern slopes get as little as 300 to 500 millimeters. Similarly, in the American Pacific Northwest, precipitation on parts of the west side of the Cascade Mountains averages up to 10 times as much as on parts of the Columbia Plateau to the east. Different sides of a mountain range often have not only different amounts of rainfall, but also different slopes. This has had important military implications, where the people on one side have found it easier to climb the gentler slope and then descend upon the other side to invade their neighbors. The locations and shapes of mountain passes have also had other military and consequently cultural impacts. The greater ease of Roman soldiers' entry through the mountain passes into Gaul, as compared to the more difficult mountain route into German regions, meant that Roman culture reached Gaul first, and only later filtered second-hand into the lands inhabited by Germans. Coastal regions. Coastal peoples have also tended to be culturally distinctive. In touch with more of the outside world, they have usually been more knowledgeable and more technologically and socially advanced than interior peoples. As with other geographically related social patterns, these are not racial, but locational. Sometimes the coastal peoples are racially or ethnically different, Germans being particularly represented on the coastal fringes of Russia at one time, for example, but the differences between the interior and the coastal peoples remain, even when they are both of the same racial stock. Thus, in the Middle Ages, the largely Slavic population of the Adriatic port city of Dubrovnik was culturally far more advanced in literature, architecture, and painting, as well as in modern business methods, than the Slavs of the interior hinterlands. In tropical Africa, likewise, the coastal peoples more in touch with outside influences were sufficiently more advanced technologically and organizationally to become enslavers of Africans farther inland. One symptom of the importance of coastal areas as cultural crossroads is that many of the lingua francas of the world have originated in such settings, whether in the Levant, on the Swahili coast of Africa, or in the ports of China and Southeast Asia. Land, climate, and waterways. Soil, of course, has profound effects on the kind of agriculture that is possible, and therefore on the kinds of societies that are possible. A pattern of farms that are passed down through the same family for generations is possible in fertile regions, but not in places where the soil is exhausted in a few years and has to be abandoned and a new site found while the first land recovers its fertility. Whole societies may have to be mobile when the land in any given location cannot permanently sustain them. This means that there cannot be cities and all the cultural developments facilitated by cities. Mobile, slash-and-burn agriculture has been common in those parts of tropical Africa and Asia where great cities failed to develop and where the indigenous people long remained vulnerable to conquest or enslavement by people from more urbanized societies and larger nation-states elsewhere. In early medieval Europe as well, Slavs in East Central Europe practiced slash-and-burn agriculture, which necessitated very different forms of social organization from those which emerged after the use of the plow enabled them to create sedentary societies. Moreover, just as the nature of agriculture has influenced where urban life is or is not feasible, so the economic and technological advances associated with cities influence agriculture. Thus, in the 16th century, the hinterlands of such flourishing cities as Venice, Milan, and Genoa saw great improvements in agricultural methods introduced. Deserts and steppes, such as those of North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia, have often produced societies on the move. These nomads have included some of the great conquerors of all time. Wave after wave of conquerors from Central Asia and the Caucasus have pushed other peoples before them into Eastern and Southern Europe over the centuries, creating a chain reaction series of conquests in the Ukrainian, Polish, and Hungarian plains and in the Balkans as those displaced moved on to displace others. Less dramatic and less extreme have been the seasonal movements in places where sheep, goats, and other animals are herded in different places at different times of the year, rather than exhaust the vegetation in one place. Here, there may be permanent dwellings where the women and children stay while the men migrate seasonally with their herds, as in the Balkans, for example. The significance of particular geographic features, mountains, rivers, climate, soil, etc., is even greater when these features are viewed in combination. For example, the effect of rainfall on agriculture depends not only on how much rainfall there is, but also on the ability of the soil to hold it. Thus, a modest amount of rainfall may be sufficient for a flourishing agriculture on the absorbent loess soils of northern China, while rain falling on the limestone soils of the Balkans may disappear rapidly underground. Similarly, the economic value of navigable waterways depends on the lands adjacent to them. Navigable rivers which go through land without the resources for either industry or agriculture, the Amazon, for example, are of little economic value, even though navigable waterways in general have been crucial to the economic and cultural development of other regions more fully endowed with other resources. In Russia as well, waterways isolated from the major natural resources of the country, as well as from each other, cannot match the economic role of rivers which flow into one another and into the sea after passing through agriculturally or industrially productive regions. Conversely, harbors that are not as deep, not as wide, nor as well sheltered as other harbors may nevertheless become busy ports if they represent the only outlets for productive regions in the vicinity, as was the case of Genoa in northwestern Italy or Mombasa in East Africa. Similarly, the port of Dubrovnik on the Dalmatian coast, strategically located for the international trade routes of the Middle Ages, flourished despite a harbor that was not particularly impressive in itself. Sometimes, a variety of favorable geographical features exist in combination within a given region, as in northwestern Europe, and sometimes virtually all are lacking, as in parts of tropical Africa, while still other parts of the world have some of these favorable features but not others. The consequences include not only variations in economic well-being, but, more fundamentally, variations in the skills and experience, the human capital, of the people themselves. Given the enormous range of combinations of geographical features, the peoples from different regions of the Earth have had highly disparate opportunities to develop particular skills and work experience. International migrations then put these people with disparate skills, aptitudes, and outlooks in proximity to one another and in competition with one another in other lands. While geographical influences may distinguish one cultural universe from another, even another located nearby, the existence of similar geographical influences and similar social patterns in distant regions of the world, marauding and feuds among mountain men, for example, means that such patterns are not national character or racial traits, but are international in scope and geographical in origin. Nor are these patterns necessarily racial characteristics, even in the limited sense of characteristics differing from one race to another for non-genetic reasons. Particular cultural universes may be largely coextensive with particular races, the Japanese culture, for example, but this is not always or inherently so. In short, geographical influences cut across national borders and racial lines, producing similar effects in different countries and different effects in various regions of the same country or among culturally different members of the same race. This is not to say that there are no national cultural influences. Clearly there are. Language, religion, and political traditions are just some of the cultural values holding together nations composed of peoples subjected to disparate other influences. The point here is simply that a recognition of distinct cultural patterns, whether originating in geography, history, or otherwise, is not the same as a belief in national character or racial traits. These things may overlap or even be congruent in some cases, but they may also be quite separate. While continents and other regions of the world may not be geographically unique, nor homogeneous within themselves, nevertheless, the ensemble of geographical influences operating in one region of the world has differed significantly from the geographical and other influences operating elsewhere. These differences are not confined to their original locations, but are also embedded in the cultures of peoples migrating from these different regions of the world. One of the more geographically fortunate parts of the world, in terms of having the natural resources needed for the development of a modern industrial economy, has been northern and western Europe. Iron ore and coal deposits, the key ingredients of steel manufacturing and the heavy industry dependent on it, are concentrated in the Ruhr Valley, in Wales, in Sweden, and in the region so bitterly fought over by France and Germany, Alsace-Lorraine. The broad coastal plains of northern Europe have also provided the peoples of that region with much prime agricultural land and with navigable rivers crisscrossing these lands, knitting large areas together economically and culturally. The fact that Europe has many peninsulas, islands, and numerous harbors gives the continent excellent access to the sea. The Gulf Stream warms Western Europe to give it milder winters than places at similar latitudes in the Western Hemisphere or in Asia. London, for example, is farther north than any place in the 48 contiguous United States, yet it has milder winters than New York City, much less cities in Minnesota or Wisconsin. Eastern, Central, and Mediterranean Europe do not share all these advantages. The Gulf Stream's influence on the climate of European nations on the Atlantic becomes progressively less in the more distant central and eastern portions of the continent, where rivers are frozen for more days of the year and where winters are longer and more bitterly cold. The natural resources required for modern industry are also less abundant and in many cases virtually non-existent in Central and Eastern Europe. The broad coastal plains of northern Europe have no counterparts in the Balkans, where hills and mountains come down close to the sea, and the coastal harbors often have no navigable rivers to link them to the hinterlands. Spain has likewise been lacking in navigable rivers, and Sicily lacking in both rivers and rainfall. These sharp differences in geographical advantages have been reflected not only in great disparities in wealth among the different regions of Europe, but also in similarly large differences in skills, industrial experience, and whole ways of life among the peoples of these regions. Thus, when the peoples of the Mediterranean migrated to the United States or to Australia, for example, they did not bring with them the industrial skills or the whole modern way of life found among German or English immigrants. What they did bring with them was a frugality born of centuries of struggle for survival in the less productive lands and waters of the Mediterranean, and a power of endurance and persistence born of the same circumstances. The ability of the Italian immigrants to endure poor and cramped living conditions and to save out of very low wages, which caused comment among those around them, whether in other European countries or in the Western Hemisphere or Australia, had both geographical and historical roots. Similar characteristics have marked various other Mediterranean peoples. But the Italians are a particularly interesting group to study because they include not only the Mediterranean people of the south, but also people from the industrial world of the Po River Valley in the north, whose geographical, economic, and cultural characteristics are much more similar to those found among northern and western Europeans. The enduring consequences of the different skills and experiences possessed by people from different parts of Europe can be seen in the fact that the average income of immigrants from southern and eastern Europe to the United States in the early 20th century was equal to what was earned by the bottom 15% among immigrants from England, Scotland, Holland, or Norway. Illiteracy was higher among immigrants from southern and eastern Europe. In school, their children tended to lag behind the children of either native-born Americans or the children of immigrants from northern and western Europe, and their IQ scores were often very similar to those of American blacks, and were sometimes lower. Nor was all this peculiar to American society. In pre-World War II Australia, immigrants from southern Italy, Dalmatia, Macedonia, and the Greek countryside were typically illiterate and spoke primarily their local dialects rather than the official languages of their respective home countries. More than three-quarters of these southern European immigrants to Australia were from the rugged hills or mountains, the steep coastlines or islands of the region, rather than from the urban areas or plains. Although these remote areas were eventually drawn into the modern world, the skills of their peoples continued to lag behind the skills of peoples in other parts of Europe that were more industrially advanced, and this was reflected in their earnings in Australia, as in the United States. As late as the 1970s, the median earnings of immigrants to Australia from Greece, Italy, or Yugoslavia fell below the earnings of immigrants from West Germany or from English-speaking countries. Southern Europeans in Australia remained underrepresented in professional and technical occupations, and from nearly half among the Italian immigrants to an absolute majority among the Greek and Yugoslavian immigrants were unskilled laborers. Asia has likewise had sharp cultural divisions, many growing out of its geography. The world's highest mountain range, the Himalayas, separated Asia's two great ancient civilizations, those of China and India, which developed independently of one another to a greater extent than any of the civilizations of Europe or the Middle East. China, in particular, was a world of its own and clearly the most advanced nation on earth for many centuries. One sign of its preeminence was that Chinese goods were for long in great demand in Europe, while Europe had nothing to offer in return except gold and silver. The compass was in use in China's maritime trade decades before it was introduced to Europeans by the Arabs, and books were printed in China centuries before the Gutenberg Bible was printed in Europe. Chinese silks and porcelain were in demand in Asia, Europe, and Africa. While Chinese culture had a major impact on the cultures of Korea and Japan, and an influence felt as far away as Persia and Russia, there were few external cultural influences on China itself from the 8th through the 13th centuries. Yet very little of China's culture was spread by migration, certainly nothing to compare with the later massive spread of European culture to the Western Hemisphere, not only by the movement of millions of Europeans, but also by the Europeanization of both the indigenous populations of the Western Hemisphere and the millions of descendants of Africans brought to the New World. The Japanese are a reminder that a meager natural resource base alone is not enough to prevent industrial development, though it may prevent such development from arising spontaneously from within the given society. Japan's industrialization was transplanted from Western Europe, notably England and Scotland, and from the United States, as a result of deliberate decisions made by the Japanese government amid a national fervor to catch up with the West. Why this happened in Japan, but not in India, Abyssinia, or the Balkans, is a profound question with few answers or even systematic explorations. Many centuries earlier, Japan was likewise very receptive to cultural and technological imports from China, which at that point represented the most advanced culture in the world. In short, geography is a major influence, but not a predestination. Otherwise, nations like Japan and Switzerland would be among the poorer nations of the world instead of among the most prosperous. Even after large numbers of Chinese, Japanese, and Indians migrated to other countries around the world, the cultures they took with them had little or no effect on others outside their own respective groups. To a greater or lesser extent, these migrants from Asia tended to assimilate at least the outward veneer of the Western societies in which they settled, though retaining their own work patterns and discipline, which enabled them to rise to prosperity in these countries. The southwestern part of Asia, known as the Middle East, has also sent abroad migrants whose cultural endowments reflect the geographical circumstances in which their societies evolved. Lacking both the spontaneous abundance of food found in parts of the tropics and the natural resources for modern industry found in northern Europe, the peoples of the Middle East have historically had to struggle to make a living, whether in the nomadic pattern of the Bedouins of the desert or in the irrigated farming of others, or, perhaps most striking of all, in the middleman traders who originated in this region and spread throughout the world. The economically strategic location of the Middle East, for centuries a crossroads of trade between Europe and Asia, fostered the development of many trading ports and many trading peoples, of whom the Jews, the Armenians, and the Lebanese have been particularly prominent, not only in the Middle East itself, but also in other countries on every inhabited continent. These kinds of immigrants, middleman minorities, from this part of the world, have had patterns of skills and aptitudes strikingly similar to those of the overseas Chinese who originated in similarly demanding regions of southern China, where trade was part of their survival skills in a geographically unpromising region for industry, but which had trading ports. The geography of Africa. In understanding Black Africa, geography is more important than history. Fernand Braudel. In a strictly geographical sense, all the peoples on the continent of Africa are Africans, from the whites of South Africa to the Arabs of the Mediterranean states, but the term has in practice come to refer primarily to the indigenous peoples of Africa below the Sahara, to Black Africans. The basis for this focus is not simply racial, but historic, cultural, and geographic as well. As with the British, the Slavs, and others, the influence of geography in Africa has not been simply in its effects primarily on things, natural resources or economic prosperity, for example, but on people. More specifically, the effect of geography in making cultural interactions more difficult has been particularly striking, as between the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa and the outside world, as well as among themselves. To their north is a desert more vast than the continental United States, and to the east, west, and south are the Indian, Atlantic, and Antarctic oceans. Moreover, the smooth coastline of sub-Saharan Africa has offered few harbors which